Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with the authors of a study of quaking aspens in our area, Georgie Corkery and Paul Rogers. Later on, Park City Planning Director Rebecca Ward and Planning Commissioner Bill Johnson will be talking about what's next with the Bonanza Park Small Area Plan now that it's received final approval from the City Council. And Summit County Animal Control Director Chad Keel and Officer Lorinda Chilson discussing their services that the animal control provides Summit County residents. Good morning. Well, a huge internet outage, as you have heard, is affecting flights at the Salt Lake City International Airport this morning. So again, if you are leaving or have a flight coming in, you may want to check that flight tracker just to make sure what's going on across the country. FlightAware, a flight tracking platform, reporting that more than 700 U.S. flights have been canceled. Nearly 1,200 flights have been delayed due to these IT issues. Although most of the major issues originated on the East Coast, airports across the country have been impacted, and as you heard from NPR, banks and other agencies as well. The outage has been linked to cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike. The company's CEO says the outage was not due to a security incident. Well, the Park City School District expects to cut the ribbon on two construction projects at the beginning of the school year. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has details.
The expansions at Jeremy Ranch and McPullen Elementary Schools are nearing completion. They're slated to open for the school year in August. Both projects involved adding spaces for preschool and daycare. Park City School District COO Mike Tanner said similar work is also underway at Parley's Park and Trailside Elementary Schools, although it's unclear when those projects will be finished.
Yeah, we did experience permitting delays, both with Summit County and also with the State Board of Education's project number application process.
Park City voters approved a $79 million bond in 2021 to help pay for six construction projects at the school district. The total work cost is more than $130 million. All of the projects are about a year behind the original schedule because of delays. After the 2024-25 school year, Treasure Mountain Junior High will shut down. Ninth graders from Treasure Mountain will move to Park City High School. Eighth graders will attend Ecker Hill Middle School. The school district is adding classrooms to the high school and Ecker Hill to make room for the new students. Those projects are now scheduled for completion by fall 2025. The district is also considering building a new sports complex on the Treasure Mountain site after the school is demolished. Tanner said the Park City School District Board of Education has several different concepts to consider, each with different price tags. The cheapest option involves building two new baseball and softball fields.
Just adding the ball fields and doing site work, dugouts associated with that is about $7.1 million. If we move and add tennis courts and a support building on that site, that's going to add another $5.4 million. And if we tear down Treasure and convert that space to two lacrosse or football practice fields, that's going to add another $10 million to the price tag. So that entire Treasure Mountain sports complex could total about $23 million.
The Board of Education is scheduled to discuss athletics facilities at its meeting August 20th. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
Well, one person has died after a fiery crash on State Route 224 early yesterday morning. According to the Utah Highway Patrol, a 2019 Subaru WRX was driving southbound on 224 near Kearns Boulevard at about 1:30 in the morning when it veered off the road and hit a tree. The car caught on fire and the 29-year-old driver and only person in the vehicle died at the scene. Troopers say a witness reported the WRX was racing another vehicle before the crash. Authorities are trying to find that other driver. Both lanes of State Route 224 were closed until about 5:45 Thursday morning. KPCW will update the story as more information becomes available. Last we heard, the driver had not been identified. Well, the results of a recent study done on the quaking aspens in the Snyderville Basin was recently released. They're on the phone to tell us more about the study and what they found. I have the lead author of the report, Georgie Corkery, a former student researcher at the Utah State University, and Paul Rogers, who is the director of Western Alpine Alliance at USA. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, and that's Western Aspen Alliance.
Oh, thank you. I just misspoke. I had it typed right. So, Georgie, you did this research. This was part of your capstone project for a master's degree?
This was just part of my master's research.
Okay.
And natural resources. A lot of times when you go in to get a graduate degree, you also are just doing research at the same time, so you can specialize in subjects.
All right. So what did you set out to do?
Well, I didn't set out to do it, but it fell into my lap, and I'm so glad it did. I was looking for a research project that would be more ecology-centered because I have more of a social science background. And I found Paul and my other advisor, Dr. Anna Miller, and they had this project in collaboration with Snyderville Basin Special Recreation District. They just go by Basin Recreation. They're over in Summit County. And they were curious to know what's going on with an aspen stand in one of their recreation areas. And so all together, we kind of tackled that project to answer the question, what's going on here?
All right. So you specifically studied the Run Amok Dog Park and then the trail area known as RTS. It's the Right Turn Sage. And again, so that was done based on what Basin Rec had asked, huh?
Yes, yeah. They were looking around, and the aspen ecologist specialist in the area is Paul Rogers. So, you know, he's at Utah State, and they reached out, and it ended up being a really cool project.
Okay, so how did you conduct this research here then? I mean, what was it that you went out and did?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a two-part answer. The first thing that we did was go out and look at the trees, to see what's going on with the aspens themselves. So we were out in the field one summer, and we had randomly selected 45 plots where the aspen are, because you want to randomize it, right? You don't want any bias. And myself and my field tech, Piper Christensen, who was amazing, we went out and we counted the trees. We looked to see if there was damage on them. We saw if they were browsed or not. And to be browsed means eaten by ungulates, which is, you know, elk, deer, and moose. And so we looked at all sorts of things, and we took a soil sample. And I took those soil samples into the lab to see, you know, what might be going on in the soil. And then the second part of the study is I went out the next summer and we surveyed the people, because what is part of this ecosystem, this recreation area, is very much the people, and in this case, their dogs.
All right. So what kind of damage were you seeing with the trees?
Yeah. So I can't really answer that totally definitively, as a maybe classic scientist would say to you, but some things that we saw was that there was definitely high browse, so high ungulate presence in the RTS area, or a higher presence over there. So what that means is that you have young aspen, well, we call them stems, but for this case, for this explanation, we'll call them trees. We have young aspen trees, and the ungulates will eat the top of them, and that prevents them from going up. They'll kind of grow out and then back up and on another branch. So they become really shrubby. And if that keeps happening, basically those young trees can't grow up. So that's one thing that we saw. And that was one thing that we expected to see, because that happens in other areas, which we can talk about in a minute. And then something else that was really curious was that we saw a high sodium in the soil. Also called, or another way to measure that would be sodium absorption ratio, which is high. And what can happen in that situation, if you have a lot of sodium in the soil, it makes the soil somewhat impenetrable. So water can't go down through the soil. It will sit on top of the soil. And it can prevent roots from moving through the soil easily, and it can prevent roots from soaking up water. So even if there's a lot of water, it might be pooling on top, and it can prevent, you know, those roots from taking up water, which all trees, all plants need.
All right. And
so that's something that we saw.
Yeah. And then what you kind of wanted, the basis here was that there's a lot of recreation-related activities happening in this area. So how did recreation impact the results that you were seeing there?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and really interesting in this case, because we weren't necessarily looking at how recreation impacted aspen. per se. That's not something we were pursuing. We were looking at how the Aspen impacted the recreation, and that was more of the social study part. But some things to think about that we did not measure, but, you know, we noticed in the area and we're wondering how they could impact it, is that two parts. The first one is that in RTS, it's in the winter used as a cross-country ski area. And in order to have a cross-country ski path, you need to mow trails, right? So there aren't any trees so that you can ski without hitting a tree. No one wants that. And in a way, that serves the same function as browsing, right? You're preventing aspen from growing in those areas, which, as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, especially, you know, being in Utah, aspen is, they are clonal. So one organism, well, multiple trees are likely one organism. So if you're constantly cutting down these new saplings coming up, you're stressing out the larger organism that is there. So it's just like chronic stress if you're cutting down or browsing on those young aspen. And that's not something that we looked at, but it's something that we would want to look at moving forward. You know, how is that mowing for the cross-country ski trails impacting aspen there? And then the second part to this is that the broader area or above, uphill, upstream, is Utah Olympic Park, which is really cool. It made it a really cool study site to be at. But there's been a lot of construction there. And, you know, in preparation for potential future Olympics, there's more construction and development. And so we're wondering, you know, is that development, is that kicking up dust? Maybe there are chemicals used that are then coming downstream. And like I said, we tested soil samples, and maybe that's contributing to the high salinity. And we only tested for certain things. We could have missed different pollutants that could be coming in and affecting the stand. So that's kind of the two part of what might be happening, but that's speculative. We don't know definitively, but hopefully moving forward, Basin Recreation wants to do more research in the area.
Hmm. Well, and I think I read in the study is that the construction there of the UOP workforce and athlete housing back in 2019 may have made a difference as it altered the stream that flows through the area. So the stream altered in the sense that it was in one area, and then what? It got moved to, what, a parking lot where we know cars park and is salted and maybe cars just melting the salt off the vehicles?
Yeah, good point to bring up. The stream kind of ran parallel to the road, or at least started more parallel, and then once the end of this construction for the residential housing, that ended in 2019. Now the stream basically runs from, if you look at the map, the runoff is coming from that parking lot area. And so, you know, salting in the winter, that's something we do here in Utah. And salt is different than sodium, but I think it's not far off to draw some connection there.
And then what about, there's a lot of other skiing and other winter sports happening at the UOP. Certainly snow additives, I believe, are added, including salt, right, to keep the ski surfaces firm. Could that also cause some aspen decline?
Yeah, absolutely. That's some great speculation on your part. We don't know what is the cause, but, you know, something that we recommended for Basin Rec, the folks overseeing this area, is to do more soil sampling and testing for more chemicals. So not just in the 45 plots that we were at, but in addition to those, testing more and over time and in the stream, so the water itself, and, you know, seeing what the source might be. So I think that's a really good question to ask.
Yeah. I want to bring in Paul Rogers, again, the director of the Western Aspen Alliance there at Utah State University. And when she talked about the mowing, and I think it's probably more of not necessarily the mowing, but the plowing, you know, the compaction of the ski trail, Paul. For those of us who fight against the aspen that continue to berate our lawns, How do we do that? I mean, how do we get rid of them if we don't want them?
Yeah, that's a tough question. Yeah, I was hoping to keep the conversation sort of focused here on the site. But first of all, I appreciate the invitation to talk with your audience about this topic. In Utah, people really love aspen and around the West. And a few years back, about 10 years ago, we declared it our state tree. But sometimes you have more aspen than you want, right? And maybe the aspen would say, you have more lawn than I want. So it probably runs both ways, Leslie. But in relation to this study, what's really cool is that that people seem to have a natural affinity and a love for aspen. And so one of my jobs is to connect that to the ecological value. And both here and all the way up to the global scale, from the local to the global scale, aspen contribute to biodiversity. And this is one of our big, big ecological global issues these days. So getting people to appreciate something that they seem to have a natural liking for and connecting that to its ecological value is one of our tasks. And we in this study, we just saw a lot of real true interest in not only the condition of the aspen, but what we might do going forward, as Georgie kind of spoke to already.
Yeah, and I guess how I understand it, aspen seem to be sort of the first trees that start in a mountain forest. As they grow taller, they provide the shade that would be needed for the smaller conifers to grow. Once those conifer grows, they kind of kill out the aspen because then there's no sun for the aspen. So isn't that how it is supposed to work? I mean, and why should we be worried about dying aspen forest?
Yeah, great question. Now, that's about a half an hour answer, which I won't subject your audience to. But in some cases, conifers compete with aspen and others they don't. At this site, we pretty much have pure aspen and we're not too concerned about conifers taking over time. However, what's going on right now in the state is wildfires, and wildfires are really important in a positive way, generally speaking, for aspen ecosystems. And so we had a long history of trying to control fire, and we actually need fire for our environment. So obviously, as long as it's not hurting people or structures. So we do need those renewing cycles going on, and sometimes we interrupt them. And Georgie already started speaking to this idea of ungulates or browsing animals. And a lot of the viewers aren't going to realize that we have an overabundance of those animals in some locations, in particular places, ironically, where they're protected. For example, where hunting's not allowed, the animals quickly learn where they're not going to be hunted. And therefore, we have more browsing and less aspen development over time. So as I get into a tangle of issues, you can see there's a lot of balancing acts between different factors going on. And that's one of the things that we were trying to unravel in this study, is trying to understand these different factors.
Yeah, again, your expertise on aspen forest conditions in Utah and the West. So did Georgie's results tell you something that you didn't know?
They did, actually. In particular, this unique interaction and the role of recreationists. One thing that surprised us, and again, we're sort of out on the speculation lane here, is that the presence of dogs in run amok probably keeps at least some of those browsing ungulates at bay. And so this is something new to me, and I've been looking at these issues for a long time. And so perhaps we can use that in our management tactics going forward. Now, caution your readers, I'm not telling everybody to go out and get 10 dogs and bring them all out there. But perhaps there's some benefits of that. On the other side, you know, leaving the waste out there from the dogs and other impacts from dogs can be problematic. So, again, another balancing act.
Are you done with this story then, Georgie, or study? Are you done with this? Or do you?
Yeah.
Okay, because I was going to ask, I mean, would you look at other areas to corroborate this? And I'm thinking particularly of all the dying aspen in the upper elevations of State Route 224 headed up to Empire Pass. I mean, the forest there appears devastated, and that's close to the road, and I'm guessing construction or mowing or salt on the road, heavy exhaust from vehicles could probably even corroborate your study further.
Well, I'll answer that by saying I've completed my master's, and very quickly, without I didn't expect this, I got a job kind of in a different field looking at Great Salt Lake. But what I'm hoping is that Basin Recreation wants to continue partnering with Utah State University, and whether I'm just like reading papers that are published through that, I hope to stay involved in and tuned in to any projects that are done. But Anna Miller, again, my other advisor, Dr. Anna Miller, I'm hoping that she and Paul could, you know, moving forward, look broader in Summit County and see what's going on, and, you know, especially at my site, Run Amok and RTS, to kind of keep chasing the ball on this one and see, you know, what is causing these things, and maybe that could be expanded and useful for other researchers, other aspen ecologists in other areas, and other recreation ecologists in other areas.
All right. So you provided me with a link to your study. Is that shareable for our listeners if they wanted to read it?
Yes, okay. Please.
All right. Well, great. We will post that as part of this interview. Anything else that you wanted to add, either Paul or Georgie?
I did want to add one thing, and I have a feeling Paul does too. But again, I wanted to emphasize that this is the link that you're sending out is one part of a two-part study. The other part was asking the recreators how they valued aspen in the area and generally speaking. And what we found is that a lot of people that visited, that participated in the survey, they would support any management action to keep the aspen in the area, which I think is high praise for Basin Recreation themselves, because people know who they are and they really appreciated the work that they do, but also that people do value aspen for whatever reason. Everybody had a story to share with me about how much they loved aspen, or in some very few cases, how they wanted to get them out of their yard, which is out of both of our scopes. But it was, you know, it was a great study to do. I'm so happy I was able to do it. And I'm honored that y'all wanted to bring me and Paul onto the show.
And Paul, any final words?
Yeah, I'll keep it brief. I do appreciate that comments by Georgie. I think that pretty much nailed it. But the interest in this recreation ecology, combining the human interest with the ecological value, is really something that we're excited about, and there's a lot of potential in the greater Park City area to pursue these studies.
Okay. Well, Paul Rogers, Georgie Corkery, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, as we've reported, the Park City Council approved the Bonanza Park Small Area Plan last week, and in the studio to tell us what happens from here, I have Park City Planning Director Rebecca Ward, along with Park City Planning Commissioner Bill Johnson. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
So we call this, Rebecca, a small area plan, but how many acres are we really talking about?
So the Bonanza Park neighborhood includes about 200 acres. It's the area that includes Snow Creek and then the Bonanza Park neighborhood between Park Avenue, Kearns Boulevard, Bonanza Drive, and Deer Valley Drive.
Okay. So as part of the plan approval, did the zoning change?
So what the approval of the small area plan does is it provides a high level policy document that we can then look to as we go through amendments to the land management code for the new recommended regulations to apply to future development. We need to take that additional step and now implement the recommendations of the plan through code amendments.
Okay, so is that just done based on what is in the plan, or is that based on what applicants come and ask for as part of the plan?
So first we'll need to go through and implement the recommendations for the small area plan. Those code amendments go through Planning Commission review and recommendation to the City Council. Once the City Council, if they adopt the recommended amendments, then any application coming in after those amendments are recommended, those new regulations will apply to those future applications.
All right. So what do you anticipate seeing in terms of those in terms of those changes then to the land management code?
So right now, the neighborhood, the Bonanza Park neighborhood, is really centered around commercial uses. The background of the the agricultural and industrial uses that shaped what we have right now with our street network has led to a commercial neighborhood that's really auto-centric. And what the recommendations in the small area plan include are to go through and create a new mixed-use zone. So right now, the zoning is really to prioritize commercial. This would allow for commercial on the street level, really active restaurants, retail, bar uses, with then more residential uses on upper levels. So you create a true neighborhood where people can live and also people can come.
So, Bill, does that mixed-use zone exist at this point, or is it going to be a two-year process like we saw, probably longer than that, out in Snyderville Basin?
I don't think it's going to be a two-year process. I think that Director Ward has obviously already lined up some consultants to help us with these land management code amendments, and so we are ahead of the game a little bit there, but it will take some time to work through the process with the Planning Commission and the City Council, so I don't see it taking 2 years now.
Okay, so this is a new zone then, Rebecca?
It will be a new zone for Park City, yes.
Okay, so explain what a mixed-use zone would look like.
So a mixed-use zone would encourage, like I was saying, those really active uses at the street level with residential uses for the upper levels. And the recommendations of the code are to transform the neighborhood. Right now there's a predominant surface-level parking to instead create a vibrant mixed-use neighborhood that allows for pedestrian and cyclist connectivity and transit improvements.
Mm-hmm. Would the existing general commercial zone, the GC zone, remain?
No, so the recommendations of the plan would be to update that zone to become, right now there's a mix of different zones within this neighborhood, so we would bring those all together and create a completely new zone for these acres.
Okay, so currently there is an existing 35-foot height limit. Does that stay under this new zone change?
So yes, the 35-foot height would remain with a potential increase up to 45 feet if there are community benefits.
Okay, that's the density bonus. How much does that add?
So through the recommendations of the plan, really, the height is not the only way that a developer could come forward for a bonus for the site. It can be site specific. So there are other recommendations. It doesn't necessarily mean height. It could also mean reductions to setbacks or reductions to parking. But one thing that we'll be looking into as this is implemented is if there is that allowance for the 45 feet, how that could be really compatible with the neighborhood, similar to the design requirements for the affordable master plan developments that have step backs and other design features.
Okay, I want to get to the setbacks and parking in just a bit, but let's talk a little bit about the density bonus being awarded for community benefits. Can you define community benefit?
I think that's going to be the challenge within this process, right, is that we need to somehow, you know, work with the consultants to codify a matrix system, point system, some sort of tier system potentially within the code to allow for these community benefits in exchange for these density bonuses. So that's going to be the most challenging and most important part of these code amendments, and so we really are looking forward to the public coming out and providing input and working with them, because we are attempting to codify, you know, we want to give, you know, the developers are asking for a little bit of surety and some flexibility within the code so that they come in with applications and have some way to proceed, and so this is really going to be the challenge for us, you know.
All right, well, in the past, it was open space and affordable housing that were deemed community benefits. Is that still the case here? Not when you're talking about more density.
No. Yeah. I think, well, obviously those, you know, those are part of our community needs. So yes, those are still included. But there's, you know, additionally, we could look at, you know, a potential transit hub, you know, deed restricted commercial potentially. We could go down that road, or capital, you know, some sort of capital improvement fund that could help with some of our capital projects around town. So there's a lot of areas where we can we can add those into the community benefits. And I think part of the challenge with the code will be, you know, as we start checking boxes off of these community benefits, you know, the priorities shift, right? So the level of that, you know, maybe affordable housing is number one now, but if you add two projects with affordable housing, you want to kind of bump into something, you know, another community benefit so that we have a nice, vibrant neighborhood, which we heard through the Bonanza Park Small Area process.
Right, and in that area, we have a lot of affordable housing, right? I mean, it's probably the least expensive housing in within city limits at this point. So, I mean, is that where all of the affordable housing gets built?
I mean, this is the challenge that this 200-acre site is going to give us, right? Because we have, like you said, you know, we have a lot of projects in process, like the Homestake project or Engine House, and then we also have HOPA that has its approval as well, and we have potential applications already in process that add a little more affordable housing. So do we want to look at providing, you know, a little more open space or, you know, something, additional community benefits will make the neighborhood as vibrant as we want it to.
Yeah, you expand the boundary, though. We also got the Claim Jumper and the Homestake condos. We've got Aspen Villa and the Silver Meadows, right? So
absolutely.
Are we creating, I guess it's just like, I mean, when we think, I know that Snyderville Basin Planning Commission spent so much time on integrating affordable housing, and it doesn't feel like that's what we're doing. It feels like we're putting all of the affordable housing in this area.
And I think the recommendations of the small area plan is that this is an opportunity for deeper affordability as part of mixed-use projects. There is also the recommendation that this be a neighborhood with attainable and market-rate housing. So I think as we go through the implementation process, there will be that opportunity for balance in the neighborhood.
Yeah, so this new mixed use does encourage additional housing by making residential uses by right rather than by conditional use. So what does that mean? Does it allow, just makes it easier then?
The review process would be more streamlined. Right now, any residential use in the neighborhood goes through a conditional use permit with Planning Commission review. By changing the allowances within the mixed-use zone, that review process would be simplified moving forward.
All right, let's talk a little bit about the frontage protection zone that you had mentioned. At some point, I think city planners thought it was important to protect the corridor so that we didn't have commercial businesses building three-story buildings with zero setbacks blocking the mountain view. Has that thinking changed?
I think, you know, going through this process, the frontage protection zone was one of the more, you know, discussed items through this, you know, through the engagement and what the MKSK, the consultants, provided us. And I think ultimately what the Planning Commission and City Council has taken action on is we're essentially going to keep that frontage protection zone intact as it is. But we are going to allow for some flexibility within the first 30 feet. So if you look at the frontage protection zone, it's an overlay zone. It's a 0 to 100-foot setback. And I think it's important to kind of just dissect that into two parts, right? So from 0 to 30 feet under our current code and what's being proposed, there's no development allowed within that area. We can do sidewalks. We can do some minor community benefits. So within that section and this updated plan, we're going to allow for a little more flexibility with art installations and some added funk, for lack of a better word, to that area. Now from the 30 to 100 feet, under the existing code, and what we're proposing is you're allowed to develop within that area. However, it's a conditional use, and it goes through the Planning Commission process and goes through the CUP criteria laid out in our code. And I think ultimately why we decided to keep it intact initially is to just allow for that site-specific, you know, evaluation, right? So we want to have some flexibility in that area because, you know, part of this plan, we want more connectivity in an area that you and I both know has been a desert of connectivity from a walkable and bikeable standpoint for historically, right? So allowing for that flexibility with that frontage protection zone is key because, you know, obviously that frontage protection zone covers, you know, three sides of the entire area, right? So it's important.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask you, Bill, at one point you had given a presentation about deed-restricted businesses. I think you had seen something like this in Telluride. So can you just briefly tell us what are they and how do they fit with this plan?
Well, yeah, so obviously City Tour, you know, I think I found it was a really great development within the town of Telluride, where they essentially, and if you take a grander look at it, they took an entire four-way intersection and they put underground parking underneath the entire section. And then they had, you know, an historic building that was being renovated on one corner, but on two corners they had two separate developments. And it was a really interesting concept. On one of the buildings they did deed-restricted commercial on the first level with market rate above it. And it was a way for them to provide space for, you know, a local nonprofit office that's much needed, or a nonprofit, you know, that's catered more towards, you know, local arts. And so it just gives it added some vibrancy to a very high-end kind of Main Street area that they have in Telluride. So the plan is asking for a local, inclusive, and so we probably are going to have to start looking at a way to be a little more flexible with our commercial uses in the area if we want that.
Yeah, and I'm not going to say that it's deed restricted, but I think we've already seen something like that with Lucky Ones providing employment for the neurodiverse in the city library building, and PC Tots also getting space in the library at a reduced cost, I think, for less expensive childcare. But how was that decision made fairly? In terms of who gets what.
And that's, you know, I just brought the idea from Telluride because I thought it was an interesting concept. As far as executing, I don't know. I know there's a lot of factors involved there. But again, you know, like as we look at these affordable housing, and we're going to have a lot, if we end up having a lot of that in that area, we need to look at some creative ways to provide that vibrancy. And I think that's a potential solution.
Okay. Rebecca, what happens now? I mean, this is where we start defining community benefits and moving forward with that.
Specific to community benefits, through the council discussion, we'll be issuing a survey to the council members to get their recommendations on how they envision these community benefits being evaluated and processed. The current recommended plan, or the adopted plan, would have community benefits reviewed and recommended by the Planning Commission and then going to the City Council for the final review and approval on that one aspect. So based on the council input, we'll take that to the Planning Commission, work through the details through public hearings, and then check in with the council as we go through that process to make sure that we're on track.
Okay, so we spent a lot of time on it. Sounds like there's still a lot more work to be done.
Absolutely.
Okay. Rebecca and Bill, thanks so much for your time this morning. I'm going to leave it there.
Thank you.
That's Park City Planning Director Rebecca Ward and Park City Planning Commissioner Bill Johnson. Well, have you lost a dog or found a cat? Well, KPCW may be the first place you turn to. Lost animals also turn up at the Summit County Animal Control Offices in Wanship. On the phone to talk more about animal control, I have Chad Keel. He is the county's field supervisor. He's also joined by Animal Control Officer Lorinda Chilson. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Appreciate you having us on.
Yeah. So, Chad, maybe start with you. What is the main job of animal control?
The great question. The main job is to provide a safe environment for all community members and also dogs. That's our biggest goal, is provide a safe environment for everybody.
Yeah. So what is it that you and your officers spend most of your time doing?
I would have to say dogs off leash and running at large. That's probably the majority of the calls that we receive. And the way we kind of deal with that is we have the ability to enforce the code, and we will issue citations. And we also patrol the county. And usually those problem areas we'll attend to mostly.
Yeah. How many employees are there in animal control?
Well, right now we have four officers, and then we have a shelter attendant that works at the shelter. And we're actually looking to increase to a fifth officer is kind of what we're looking at the future.
Yeah. I was going to say, any idea? I was going to comment, back in the 70s and 80s, dogs ruled Main Street. I mean, I think it was mayoral candidate Odie McGee who coined the term "more dogs on Main Street" as one of his campaign platforms, and certainly the title of Tom Clyde's popular park record column. But any idea how many dogs we have in Summit County?
I actually don't have the specific number, but we have many dogs here in Park City, and we're definitely busy.
Yeah, and all of them must be registered. Is that required?
Yes, that's one of the requirements.
Thank you. So we do require that all dogs in the county are licensed, and they have to do that within 30 days of residency. And this is super easy to do. You can do it in person at our facility here in Wanship at 1745 South Hoytsville, or you can go online and do it at the Summit County website under Services with Animal Control.
Okay, and why is it that dogs need to be licensed? Just so you know what's out there?
Yes, and it's our way to kind of keep track of them. Same as you have to get a Utah driver's license or ID as a person. We do require that all dogs have the same thing with the county. That way we can keep track of the rabies information, which is, again, a state and county requirement. So we're just fully aware of who's here and who owns them.
All right. Now, you mentioned rabies vaccinations that dogs, I believe, and cats are required to have. Are there other vaccinations that are mandated by state and county law?
As of right now, I do believe it's just the rabies that is absolutely mandated by state and county law.
Okay, and then the others just kind of fall in with pet health, I think, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. Any idea how many citations are issued every year?
I don't have a specific number.
Yeah.
But we do issue citations, majority for running at large.
Okay. And has that, here in Park City, we've got some off-leash dog areas, and I think being on leash is also considered having an electric collar. So while you may not see a physical leash, that there is some kind of electronic collar on dogs. Is that
Yes.
what's not happening? I mean, you're just, these are dogs without collars or tags or anything, huh?
So the only way you are in compliance with the collar code and the running at large is you have to have a physical leash on you, and you have to have the remote with you, and it has to be working. And during that time, the dog has to stay under voice and sight command of you at all time. And you do have to maintain control of the behavior of your dog. If that is not the case, you are in violation of the running at large code. But we do recommend just a physical leash. That is just easier and safer and more control over your dog.
All right. Now, you mentioned, Chad, that officers do patrol the streets. So, Lorinda, that's what you spend the majority of your time doing, patrolling the streets, or just responding to complaints?
Yes, ma'am. So we do patrol when we do have some free time. Other than that, we are out responding to calls that we receive from our shelter. People can call in here and file complaints, or we get them from dispatch, too. So every day is a little different, but if we have some extra time, we are definitely out patrolling problem areas to make sure everyone is in compliance of all the codes.
Yeah. Any idea where you spend most of your time? Is that in the Snyderville Basin or another area?
So that is kind of just depending. Some months it will be Snyderville Basin. It might be Camas or Colville areas. So we kind of go where we receive some complaints and where we know there is problem areas. So we do move around the county quite a bit, but we do try and focus all over the county and not just on one spot.
Sure. Maybe talk a little bit about barking dogs. At what point do they become a nuisance?
So
So we do have a nuisance code, and what we do is we'll issue a written warning to the dog owner about the barking, and then they'll have 10 days to correct that problem. After those 10 days, if they're still in violation of our nuisance code, then they'll be issued a citation.
And is it the dogs you find barking just because they've been left outside, or there's some wildlife, or, I mean, what gets them going?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it's a various issues. Sometimes, you know, just walking by a certain dog will set them off. Wildlife definitely is a factor in that, but we take those things into consideration. And try to work with the dog owner the best we can to try to minimize the barking.
Yeah. And then what are some of the other services that you provide for the public?
Right now, we offer a seasonal humane trap program to assist in capturing skunks, raccoons, and non-domesticated cats. We also do rabies clinics to our community members at a discounted price. We offer animal safety education to our local schools and community. We provide a safe haven for all domesticated stray animals. We also assist in finding all animals that come into our facility the best placement after we determine that they don't have an owner. And something that we're really excited about this year is we host an annual Pet Fest event at the county fair in Colville for kids 3 to 12. This year will be held August 7th at 12:30. And for more information about the fair and the schedule, you can visit the summitcountyfair.org website.
So is this where kids come bring their pets to kind of show them off?
Yes. Lorena, do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so it's kind of just like a show and tell with your pets. The kids bring them, they dress up like them. We have a look-alike section in that. So they come in little costumes. You can bring any pet. We have a miscellaneous section for pets and then also cats and dogs. And then there are prizes and medallions for all the kids that participate and win. There's a grand champion and then first, second, and third place. It's very fun. We invite everyone to come out and come see and show us your pets. And we'd love to see you guys and have you all participate.
Yeah, well, I've got you on the line, Officer Chilson. What's the best part of the job?
Honestly, just being able to serve the community. I do enjoy working with all sorts of animals. Every day is a little different. You don't know what's going to be expected of you. So it's very fun. We have a great team, and we do love working with the community members.
Yeah, what's the worst part?
I don't know.
Bad dogs.
I don't think there is a bad part, really.
How about for you, Chad?
I think Lauren answered that pretty well. I think just being out in the community, being involved with animals is a great thing. I think probably the hardest part is especially during the summertime is how busy we get. Mm-hmm. Is probably the most difficult thing. But it is great to work here in Summit County. It's a beautiful area to be in and wonderful dog owners, and it's great. It's a wonderful job.
Well, you've been in that new shelter. It's not so new anymore. Have you outgrown it?
I think it's actually a pretty good size for us. It's a beautiful facility. We have a great building here, and it works really well for us. And I think the size is great for us, and I think we're going to use this facility for a very long time, and we're pretty excited about that.
Okay. All right, and then we also heard about loose peacocks in Peoa. Did you have to respond to those?
Yes, ma'am. We did have some wild peacocks in that area, and I think we haven't heard anything from them in a few weeks, so I think that issue is kind of taking care of itself. But I think there's a couple signs up there to remind drivers to slow down through that area.
Okay. All right, you guys, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Again, that's Summit County Field Supervisor Chad Keel and Summit County Animal Control Officer Lorinda Chilson. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.